I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're going to talk about why millions of religious Americans not only continue to support Donald Trump, but believe that God specifically put him in the Oval Office. If that's actually the case, we need to have a few words with God.
We'll also discuss recent Catholic activism in some areas we don't usually hear as much about in the news. Renewing support of public sector unions, taking stands in opposition to capital punishment, and speaking out against gun violence in the wake of another deadly school shooting.
Finally, we'll take up a story many of you have heard about over the weekend. The news that Hillary Clinton's faith outreach advisor for her 2008 campaign was disciplined for sexual harassment and apparently kept on the campaign by Clinton herself after senior staff recommended that she fire him.
As some listeners may know, Nish is taking a break from Twitter. Unless and until she returns, we're going to add a segment at the top of our show called 3 Minutes of Twitter, or as some of you called it last week, 3 Minutes of Nish, in which Nish gets to do her best Lewis Black imitation about whatever it is she would have gotten out of her system if she was still unloading her thoughts 280 characters at a time. Nish, your time starts now.
Okay. On Thursday, January 25th, the New York Times dropped a report that Donald Trump made a concerted effort to fire special counsel Robert Mueller, the guy hired by the FBI to investigate Russia's involvement in our election. He almost did this back in June of 2017. The first thing I have to say is that Donald Trump is a grade A idiot. You don't pull a Nixon. That is super, super, super dumb. Also, why would you do that unless you have something to hide? That's my question. Anyway, the thing I'm pissed about is the intransigence of many in the Republican Party and their refusal to pass any sort of legislation that protects Bob Mueller and his ability to do his job. Regardless of what he discovers about the president and him possibly obstructing justice, the work that Mueller is doing is of the highest importance to our elections and our democracy. His findings could help us protect our election systems from hostile foreign nations. Spoiler alert, Russia is a hostile foreign nation. And his ability to do his job is really important in maintaining the principle that nobody is above the law, not even the president himself. If the president fired Bob Mueller, it is a profound constitutional crisis. The whole reason Mueller was hired was to protect the investigation from political interference. Congress needs to do their damn job and protect the investigation. I can't believe that Republicans would not see this as a value enough to actually do something about it. It just goes to show that they are drunk on power and don't actually care about our democracy. Anyway, that is my rant for this week.
That actually came in at under 3 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, you got extra time. Something else bothering you?
I mean, there's a lot of
Tony Perkins, perhaps.
Oh, Tony Perkins is the worst. He is the worst. Him and Robert Jeffress and Franklin Graham and Johnny Moore and all of those clowns who just continue to align themselves with Trump and his quote-unquote Christian values that they think he has. It's just disgusting. But that's, I could write a sermon on what I think about Tony Perkins. But you know what? You have more experience than I do with Tony Perkins. So,
well, and I told you last week, I filled in for you on Twitter in kind of a Nish rant
that ended so
up
proud
with telling Tony Perkins, "Get behind me, Satan." So I feel like you would have been proud.
I know. You were like, was that a little harsh? I'm like, no, totally appropriate. It's the language I would have used. I probably would have gone in a little harder. But you know what? I'm proud of you. Good job.
All right. Well, moving on. Our first topic today comes from a story Politico magazine assigned me late last week after a delegate at the World Economic Forum in Davos handed Donald Trump a book called, and I am not kidding, God and Donald Trump. "Hey, you want to read that book really fast and tell us what's in it?" wrote my editor. "Not particularly," said I. But I did anyway as part of my ongoing service to you, the people. And what I discovered was a book-length case for something I had heard some about during the 2016 campaign, which is the belief among some conservative evangelicals, particularly charismatics, that God raised up Donald Trump as his choice to win the White House and, quote, save America. Onish.
I feel like maybe you have a rant brewing inside of you, Amy. Although you really laid into it in your article. If you guys have not read Amy's Politico piece, it's fantastic. We'll link to it in our show notes. But holy cow. Yeah, what do you even say?
Well, so the book at first kind of looked somewhat familiar to me because it was giving me flashbacks to the Bush era when this was kind of a regular thing that I was doing, was reading some of the, I call them spiritual hagiographies, but there were about four or five books that came out in Bush's first term that were on like George Bush, the man and his faith. There was even a documentary that came out. You know, Bush is a man of faith, and he does have a well-documented born-again experience that he has talked about a lot. You know, he attends church regularly in Texas, and for goodness sakes, he had his whole faith-based initiative. Like, that was a key part of his domestic agenda in his first term in office. So, like, there's material there, but in any case, when somebody is writing about a president, if they don't have direct access, they're always writing around the person, and it gets really awkward when you're doing this and trying to draw out deeper truths about somebody's spiritual life, because as we know, like that's a difficult thing to judge with another person in any case, but particularly when it is the president of the United States. And so I would make a little fun of the fact that, you know, one of the books about Bush went on at length about how healthy his eating habits were and how that was a sign of him keeping his body like pure as a temple for God, which like maybe some people do, but I think that's a bit of a stretch.
I'm not a healthy eater. So what does that say about my relationship to God?
Looking at things like the good manners of White House staff and how that's clearly like a top-down thing, and it's connected to the discipline. Here's the quote. It was as though the discipline he brought to his own life of prayer and Bible study filtered down into the work habits of everyone who worked with him.
What?
And to make it clear, like, I would make fun of this, whether it was written about a Republican president or a Democratic president. Like, that is called reaching. But at least with Bush, they had something to work with. Oh my God, if you're going to be writing about Trump and his spirituality, it's, first of all, you've got to first make your way through the muck of all the counterexamples that appear to show him as a man for whom religion just does not play a part in his life. And again, that's fine, unless you're trying to argue that he really is a man of faith. And this book at least went a little light on that. There was enough to like turn my stomach a bit, and it did annoy me quite a lot that at the same time that this guy, and it's Stephen Strang, he's a longtime conservative Christian publisher and journalist. Yeah, Charisma Magazine is his thing. In fact, his Charisma Publishing House published one of the Bush spiritual hagiographies, so he's familiar with this genre. I would have had more respect for it if he had not simultaneously gone out of his way to portray Trump as a godly family man, while also dismissing Hillary Clinton as someone who, quote, was raised in the Methodist Church, but then became radicalized during her college years at Wesley. As if
radicalized.
Like, yeah, she left religion behind her when she left high school. And we know, you know, whether you like her or not, this is a woman who's been attending, yes, the Methodist Church her entire life and for whom religion is important. Again, you can like her or hate her, but it is inarguable that religion has been a bigger part of her life as a human being than it has for Donald Trump. And just kind of unnecessary knocks on Obama and accusing him of a lack of decorum, which, hello. Anyway.
That's rich.
Yeah. But all to say that the actual meat of the book is focused on something quite different. And this is where, Nish, particularly I wanted to talk to you about it, because it's focused on charismatic Christians, who we should just say for listeners, I think it's fair to put charismatics in the umbrella of evangelical Christians, but separate them out as folks who are more likely to believe that God is still speaking to people on earth and to believe more in an active hand of God in human affairs, that this was not something where God intervened in biblical times, but not in the modern day. And so these are folks who are more inclined to see the role of God in, for instance, our political lives. And there are a handful of kind of major charismatics who have talked in the last couple of years about prophecies that they say they have received. In some cases, they reported them at the time. In some cases, these appear to be conveniently remembered in hindsight that God told them Donald Trump was going to be the man for the White House. And I have a lot of thoughts about this, particularly, I guess I noticed it in the 2016 election after Trump claimed or clinched the Republican nomination, because it seemed to me a lot of these figures were operating from the assumption that God would only want a Republican in the White House. And therefore, simply by virtue of having defeated all of the other people in the Democratic primaries and getting the Republican nomination, Trump, ipso facto, was God's choice. It's kind of a very circular argument. You know, there was no acknowledgement at all that perhaps because he had been in the White House for two terms, Barack Obama could have been divinely ordained to be in that spot. It was more, well, Trump is not really our first choice, but it was almost as if he's such a wrong choice that this must be the hand of God. A kind of, in my eyes, a desperate looking for justification, and in this case, biblical justification, that that there was some good reason they as Christians could get behind Donald Trump. And if he's God's choice, that's a pretty easy one.
Right. Well, how do you argue with God, right? I mean, that to me feels like what you called a reach, you know? Regarding the charismatic stuff, I want to make sure I kind of articulate kind of the breadth of the charismatic movement. There are definitely those folks who would believe, like, you know, that God is like up there playing chess, right? You know, and he's actively moving all of these parts and making them happen. And so therefore, Donald Trump is his choice to be in the White House. Now, what that says about God's involvement in the chess game when Barack Obama was president, or when Bill Clinton was president, or pretty much anyone else beforehand.
Yeah, he sat those out.
Yeah, he was taking a water break or something. Obviously, there are a lot of holes that you could poke in that argument from both sides, just to be fair. But there's a broad swath of kind of charismatic belief. And the charismatic movement as we know it today, particularly how it's playing out in different communities that we're seeing, like Hillsong in Reading, and or not Hillsong in Reading, but Hillsong in Australia and around the world, Bethel in Reading, California, which we had talked about earlier in a previous episode. Really, it's otherwise known as kind of spirit-filled Christianity, which isn't to say that other forms of Christianity aren't spirit-filled, but the emphasis really is on the work of the Holy Spirit, on what we would consider miracles, what we would consider spiritual gifts, things like signs and wonders and speaking in tongues and prophecy and healings and all that kind of stuff. That those, the work of the Holy Spirit did not go dormant with the death of the apostles back in ancient times. That the work of the Holy Spirit is still alive today in the believers, in the body of believers, and in the church. So that's kind of the general overview of charismatic Christianity. Now, just like any tradition or any branch of any tradition, there's obviously a very wide spectrum of how that plays out. And so it's not surprising to me to see some more quote-unquote charismatic Christian leaders come out and say these types of things about God and about Donald Trump and that, you know, this is God's will. But again, it asks really important questions about, like, how can one, I mean, and this is not a topic we are going to go into at length here because we do not have 10 years. It's like, how do we know the will of God, right? Like, that's a big question. But how do some people know the will of God and others don't? And what are the indications of what God's will is? And that a particular group of people are willing, and this is the hard part for me, and I touched on a little bit earlier, is that, you know, if there's this view that God is up there playing chess, for, you know, lack of better analogy, and is moving all of these parts around and is orchestrating the whole thing, and so therefore God actively and willfully put Donald Trump in the White House and is pleased with that choice, it raises some significant questions about God when things happen that aren't in line with a quote-unquote Republican ethic, right? And that's really my question, is that how in the world can these people make that argument? And at the same time, be intellectually honest. And that ultimately, that's it for me. It's like, this is a completely intellectually dishonest argument. I mean, just the book title in it of itself, like God and Donald Trump, implies that somehow Donald Trump has a relationship with God. And anyone, I mean, I am not the judge of his heart, as we like to say in Christianity, but every indication shows me that, like, there's no fruit there. That's my thing. It's like, where's the fruit, right?
See, I read it differently, the title. And maybe it was after you know, reading through, God help me, the whole book.
And I have not read the book, so you would have to.
I read it much more as how God is using Donald Trump, or God's decision to use Donald Trump. Now, obviously.
So Donald Trump is the conduit to God's will on earth.
Yeah. Now, there's a big hole there in that Stephen Strang could not interview God to find out how God made the decision to use Donald Trump. But that is kind of the frame, is Donald Trump as, you know, instrument of God, which is how, you know, to be frank, it's how they get around all of the very difficult details of Trump's very unchristian life, and not just his personal life, but his views and his policy positions and his racism and misogyny. I mean, you know, if you argue that he is being used by God as an instrument of God's will, despite all of these troubling characteristics, then you don't have to deal with them.
Yeah. And it asks, I mean, for me, if that's what it's communicating, that book, that asks, frankly, even some, like, more troubling questions of, wow, Donald Trump is really enacting all of these horribly racist policies. And if he is the, is that God, right? Is God racist? Like, or is he sexist? Or is he, like, all, like, holy crap. I mean, that says more about what that, let me say this, that mindset could do even more damage to the quote unquote Christian witness, right? Or the work that we would hope the church would do in the world than, like, Donald Trump's own personal relationship with God and kind of sifting through some of that. Wow.
Yeah. Well, and as I've said before, I think that those questions that are raised cause real deep pain to the people who are suffering under this administration.
Oh my gosh.
And,
yes,
you know, in particular, the Christians who are suffering, because you are telling them that God is causing your pain and God wants that to happen. God wants you to be hurt, to feel fear, to have your humanity questioned. And that is just so profoundly destructive, but also just uncaring of your Christian brothers and sisters. I cannot deal with that. I did want to raise two points in relationship to this before we move on to our our next subjects, because I do think it is both fair and right to point out some similar talk around Obama's candidacy in 2008 in some Black churches. And here, you know, it was not necessarily that God was actively intervening. At least that's not how I heard it a lot of the time, although I'm sure that there was talk like that going on. It was more kind of in the vein of, you know, the amazing, you know, spiritual coincidences that happen. And here I'm thinking of, in particular, the Sunday around Martin Luther King Day in January 2008. I was down in Atlanta at Ebenezer Baptist Church, Martin Luther King's former church. Barack Obama was there, and that's why I was there with the rest of the press corps to kind of hear him. And it was incredibly heavy. And I was struck, as somebody who followed him a lot during that campaign, by just how much he seemed to be feeling it that Sunday, just on his shoulders, because the pastor there, and I'm trying to remember his name, Raphael Warmick, I think, the senior pastor, was very explicit. He was not mincing words. It was like, this year, because this was 2008, remember, is 40 years from when Martin was killed. And we know in the Bible, things happen in 40-year increments. That's an important, you know, time period. And, you know, Martin 40 years ago to now this young man coming to pick up the mantle 40 years later, like, that was all of the hopes and dreams of the Black community, in addition to the implied, you know, if Martin was doing God's work, then Barack is going to be doing God's work as well. And he is our figure to back, not just as African-Americans, but as Christians, to get him into the White House. And, you know, the difference there I would point out is that Trump seems kind of alternately amused and tickled at the idea that God would put him in the White House, whereas Obama just looked not beaten down, but, you know, that is something to put on him, especially because, you know, you're not just talking about the 40 years since King's death. You're talking about 40 years since he was assassinated for his ideas and his work. And so much of the service was also focused on, like, praying for protection over this man. And look, it's easy to look back now and forget, because he got through 8 years relatively unscathed. But at the time, it was not so easy to think that he could get elected to the White House and not also be the target of white supremacist violence himself personally or his family members. And it just, it seemed a little terrifying that Sunday.
Wow. Yeah, that's super intense. That's really, really intense. And I know that, I mean, I was still kind of moving along in my progressive views at that point, but I remember talking with some friends and a couple friends who were pastors of more progressive churches. And obviously there wasn't that, like, added piece of racial justice in some of these churches, but that, you know, that same language that conservatives are using now to talk about Donald Trump, a lot of that same language was happening around Obama at that time, even, you know, in more predominantly white progressive churches. I mean, I think we do that. I think we have this tendency to, I don't want to say deify the person, but, like, want to place all of our expectations of the goodness of God on people that simply align with our political views. And no matter which way you slice it, it definitely is its own form of dehumanization. And it can be really problematic. I mean, and it definitely asks some and incites some really difficult questions about, okay, well, what does that say about God, and what does that say about our politics and how much he cares about politics, and then therefore how much, like, well, what does he care about what's happening in Germany, or what does he care about Brexit, what does he care, like, there's all these different questions that you can ask. Like, this is not just America solely.
Yeah, I'm really glad you made that point, because I wanted to bring us back around to what I think this tells us about what we heard last week, and tragically, all of the comments of Tony Perkins and Franklin Graham and Jerry Falwell Jr. came after we recorded our Impolite Company episode last week.
Although, you know what? We had a good rant, even though we didn't get the quotes. We were still
It was a good episode, but it was maybe for the best that we would have just gone up into the stratosphere. But I think it explains why these guys have to double down in the face of everything, including, you know, the president allegedly paying off a porn star about an alleged affair right before the election. It's because they cannot admit that he was a mistake, because exactly that they have made this argument. Because if Trump was a mistake, then maybe God wasn't behind Trump's election. And maybe their ability to judge what is and is not God in the work of the Holy Spirit is wrong. And then it would just come down to the fact that they really hate Hillary Clinton and had to come up with a religious justification for it.
Yeah. Also, they really hate really Clinton, or they really hate Hillary Clinton. And also, a lot of the people who continue to support Donald Trump are super racist. Like, you know, like, there's all sorts of things that you have to wrestle with at that point. And that's one of them for sure.
Yeah. But I just think going forward, it explains why we can stop waiting. There is not going to be a point at which Perkins et al. Say, you know what? This is a line too far. We cannot support this guy anymore. They have to. They are all in.
They're all in. Because if they step out at this point, it's like it all falls apart. Everything falls
because
apart.
Because it is so intricately tied up with their theological justifications, even if it's not what they in their deepest hearts believe, that they cannot afford to let go of that argument. So they're in it for the long haul.
Yeah, which is,
we got material to spend.
I hope we don't have too much material, because I don't know about you, I'm so sick of talking about those guys.
I know. Ah. Well, let's talk about somebody else.
Let's talk about Catholic bishops.
Catholics.
That's a nice pivot. A week and a half ago, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops filed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court in favor of a public workers' labor union called American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME. Is that how you say it? For short.
AFSCME.
AFSCME. Yeah. Right. Does this indicate deeper shifts in the Catholic Church on public policy issues, or is this simply an outlier case? And in a column in Religion News Service, which we'll link to, writer Mark Silk suggests that this is actually a broader movement in the church sparked by some of the leanings of Pope Francis, and saying that if Pope Francis actually has the opportunity to appoint more bishops, which he likely will in his tenure, that this could actually be a pretty significant tectonic shift in how the bishops interact with different policy issues. And I know that we've talked about, I mean, labor unions, like, who knew? Who knew that they were going to come out in support of, like, labor unions? If you look back at the history of the church, you would see it's not that much of a surprise.
Yeah. And I wanted to say for our listeners, before you start sending us emails about, what are you talking about? The church has a long, centuries-long history of backing labor movements. Yes, I know. I have read Rerum Novarum. I know about all this history. But what we are saying is that for the last, say, 20, 30 years, the Bishops' Conference has really downplayed those issues, especially when it comes to labor, in favor of putting more focus on, say, like, religious freedom and abortion issues. And so it's the prioritizing that is changing. It's not that the Catholic Church suddenly decided that labor was important and unions matter, but that we haven't seen this kind of role that they've been willing to play in quite a long time.
Yes, exactly. And super interesting that the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty also submitted a amicus brief on this case.
On the other side.
On the other side. But they're like, it's interesting. They did it in support of quote unquote free speech, but there really isn't a religious freedom angle. And the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops kind of made that known in their own brief and saying, like, this isn't necessarily about religious freedom, which is so interesting to see this sort of rift. I mean, I don't want to call it a rift, like, because who knows what's going to happen. I mean, I'm sure there will be more places where, you know, organizations like Beckett and the bishops. Yes, there will be places where organizations like Beckett and the bishops will, you know, once again align. There's a thousand different issues. But it is super interesting to see the bishops really, you know, take this to the next level and really be consistent in their support of labor, which is fascinating. But at the same time, it's refreshing, I think. I think maybe being so steeped in kind of the evangelical political world, you're so, like, especially right now with those guys that we were just talking about, watching them kind of like shift and mold to whatever is most convenient in some ways, to watch an organization like the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops truly be consistent is really nice to see.
Well, and just to give a little background here, this is the focus on labor is not coming out of nowhere. I do agree that it could be connected to some of Pope Francis's statements over the last few years. But 2 years ago now, or I guess a year and a half ago, September of 2016, our cardinal here, Cardinal Subic in Chicago, gave an incredibly impassioned argument for why the church and labor should build on their history together. And he directly criticized right-to-work laws, which have been kind of Republican gospel for decades. And the church has kind of quietly stood back and let that happen. But Subic speaking up about it was an indication that he wasn't going to let that happen anymore. There's this Chicago priest who's really fascinating, who works for the union Unite Here, which is in Washington. And he has been appearing at a bunch of different events that have been co-hosted, and this is fascinating, between the AFL-CIO and Catholic University, their Institute for Policy Research and Catholic Studies there. And so, you know, it's a conversation, at least, that's been simmering for a little bit, and this is the first time that it's kind of broken open into an opportunity for the church to actually take a stand in the form of this amicus brief. But I would be surprised if this was the last that we heard of it. I think this is going to be the start of something.
And by, you know, asking the question of, like, is this more of a shift, not necessarily on policy position, but in maybe their vocal, kind of like vocal movement on some of these issues. Like you pointed me to a response to the recent school shooting that...
Also by Subic. Yeah, he is on fire. I'm really kind of loving being here in Chicago and getting to listen to him. Just last week after the school shootings in Texas and in Kentucky, and that he has spoken out, particularly in the context of all of the gun violence here in Chicago. He's been really, really forceful about the need to attack gun violence and to actually do something politically about it. But this was as strongly worded as I have heard him before. In the statement, he said, among other things, how many children have to die before we find the political will to do something about it? And talked about how we fail to hold our elected officials accountable for our nation's weak gun safety laws. And basically said, you know, the time is up. We got to do something about this. Which, again, is something that I think a lot of Catholic leaders would agree with, but it has not been an issue that the conference has prioritized or, you know, they certainly have not had 2 weeks of focus on gun violence the way that they have for the last however many years, 2 weeks focus on religious freedom, Fortnight for Freedom. That may be the indicator that it's real, is when you have more than just a couple of cardinals or bishops speaking out, but when you actually see the conference deciding to do something. In this case, We've got the conference deciding to do something on a labor case. We'll keep our eyes open on gun violence. And I just wanted to throw in a third example because, as all journalists know, three makes a trend. this kind of went unnoticed in the lead up to the March on Life or March for Life around the Roe v. Wade anniversary. But the bishop in Little Rock boycotted that city's March for Life this year because the organizers had brought on as their keynote speaker Arkansas's Republican Attorney General, who is very pro-death penalty and who has worked in her position as Attorney General for the execution of several prisoners who the church has tried to gain clemency for, at least, you know, get them off death row. And so he wrote a letter to his diocese, basically encouraging Catholics in Little Rock not to attend the March for Life. He said, you know, he asked them to appoint a different keynote speaker, and they didn't. And so he said, quote, "As you know, the church teaches a consistent ethic of life in which human life and human dignity must be protected from the first moment of conception to natural death and every stage in between."
Look at that consistent
pro-life
ethic.
"Even people who have
been
sentenced to death possess this dignity, which is why capital punishment must be abolished." And this I just want to highlight because we heard Pope Francis last fall kind of suggesting that perhaps the church needed to codify its opposition to the death penalty. In its history, the church has allowed kind of an exception for the use of the death penalty if a state found that the death penalty was the only way that it could enforce the protection and safety of its citizens. And the last three popes have made pretty clear that they don't think those situations exist anymore, that there really is no practical need for the death penalty. And what Francis has essentially said is we need to actually change official Catholic Church teaching. We need to change the catechism and make clear that this is not one of those like, well, agree to disagree, that no, this is a church teaching and you cannot deviate with it. And I was wondering at the time about whether this would at all change the political situation for Republicans, who very often like to say, you know, well, I disagree with the church on all these things, but it's not like abortion. Like, I have the freedom to disagree. And this is one situation where the bishop was saying, yeah, no, you don't have the freedom to disagree. Opposition to the death penalty is as important as opposition to abortion. And so I am boycotting your March for Life because of it.
Mm.
So stay tuned.
Yeah.
We will be following this.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we have another story.
Yes, Amy. For our final story this week. Last week, the New York Times and BuzzFeed broke a new story in the Me Too arena. For her 2008 campaign, Hillary Clinton employed a senior advisor named Bernd Strider, who advised her on faith outreach, which is a relatively unusual portfolio for a major Democratic campaign. But after a female subordinate complained that Strider had repeatedly sexually harassed her, and after Clinton's campaign manager advised firing him, Clinton chose to keep Strider on the campaign. He was demoted, docked several weeks of pay, and ordered to undergo counseling before ultimately, a little while later, I'm unclear on the timeline exactly, leaving the campaign. This story has understandably raised the ire of those who believe Hillary Clinton has a very mixed record of supporting women. She's good on women's issues overall, but can be muddled when it comes to specific cases of specific women, most prominently the women who have accused her husband of sexual assault. But it's a story that I think is complicated a bit by the fact that the last two Democratic nominees, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, have relied on faith advisors for pastoral support as much as for outreach and policy expertise. And it also brings up questions about how seriously Democrats take outreach to people of faith. We should note that Strider was not on Clinton's 2016 campaign, and that operation included virtually no faith outreach. I also wanted to note before we start discussing this that this is also a very personal story for me. I have known Burns for more than 14 years as a source, as a sometimes colleague, and as a friend. I am even better friends with some former colleagues of his at the Elezon Group, which he co-founded with my friend Eric Sapp. It's the first progressive consulting shop to focus on providing guidance to Democratic politicians on religious issues and outreach, among other things. They also work with nonprofits and corporate clients, but that was kind of how they made their name and was the bulk of their work at the very beginning. And as you probably know by now, I care very deeply about the cause of getting progressives to recognize that there are people of faith within their ranks and to understand that religious faith can motivate people to work on behalf of progressive causes and sometimes for Democratic candidates, just as it can folks across the aisle who support Republican candidates and causes because of their faith. And so I do worry, given how tentative the acceptance of that argument is on the left, that having perhaps the most senior ranking guy who was out there advising Democratic candidates be brought down on issues of personal misbehavior and being sexually inappropriate to subordinates, which I do not countenance at all. I worry about what that will do for these efforts overall.
Those are really good questions. And one of the things that I would like to chat about a little bit is that idea of there are people in campaigns. So you have Bernd Strider in the 2008 campaign for Hillary Clinton. You know, I also think of Josh Dubois, friend of the podcast here. You know, these guys are the people directing the faith outreach for the entire campaign, but they are also close, like, personal faith advisors to these Democratic candidates. And the question is, for me, like, does that show, like, a lack of depth on the bench, essentially, for the Democratic Party on issues of faith? I mean, that does to me, because if these guys are, you know, almost having to, like, double up, you know what I mean? Like, we're having to double duty here. Like, I'm not only going to personally advise and be kind of a pastoral voice for this person, but I'm also going to direct all of the faith outreach for the campaign. It seems to me like you could probably find more than one person. You know what I mean? Like, you could find someone to provide pastoral support to the candidate personally, but then also find someone who's incredibly strategic and can do all the campaign stuff. Now, it's not to say that those two things are never, you know, there's not crossover in those two areas. Those two, the two people that I mentioned may very well be the same person that has those skills. But to me, it seems like this is really just another, like, indication that there is a lack of depth on the Democratic Party and unwillingness in the Democratic Party to talk about and be robustly staffed in order to talk about issues that are important to people of faith. And I know that a lot of folks on the left will say, you know, well, we don't need to appease those people, right? Like, we can win without them, right? Why would we welcome pro-life people into the party when it's clear that we can win without them? Or, like, whatever the case may be. But that feels like a pretty myopic view, because even folks who are progressive or even folks who are concerned, like, there's a broad spectrum of political belief that encapsulates a broader umbrella of people of faith. And, you know, what does the lack of personnel in the Democratic Party on some of these issues, as opposed to what always seems like a very robust staffing on the Republican side, you know, what does that say about the Democratic Party's unwillingness to engage in some of these issues? I mean, there are obviously a ton of things to say about Hillary Clinton specifically and, you know, shielding this person from getting fired, and we can go on and on and on about that too. But to kind of keep it in the window of faith and politics, this is a question that I continually ask about the Democratic Party is, and I want to ask them, and I want to ask leaders of the Democratic Party of, like, what do you have to lose, really? Like, what do you have to lose to start engaging on this stuff?
There was a Gail Collins column in the New York Times about Burns and Hillary over the weekend that included just a pitch perfect Gloria Steinem quote, just not in the way that maybe she thought, that I had to highlight, because she's quoted as saying, quote, "I don't understand why any political campaign would have a faith advisor on paid staff." To which I said, Gloria Steinem answering her own question. Yep, that's yes. That's why the Democratic Party needs people who understand that religion matters to some folks.
A lot of folks.
Yeah. You know, I obviously have a lot of thoughts about this, including the fact, and, you know, I do not... this was the first that I had heard about any of this when I read it in the New York Times, and then a couple days later in BuzzFeed. So I don't know what's going on. I've been in touch with Burns just to offer him my support as a friend. But you know, I feel for the women who worked with him, and I believe them. And, you know, I don't support what he may have done and what he's alleged to have done. But I do want to say, just for how I think the story is being framed, that for Clinton, I believe it was a different calculation for her than if, say, just a random policy advisor was accused of the same thing, and she would have to decide, yes, no, keep this guy on staff. As you say, both Burns and Joshua Dubois played kind of pastoral roles for the candidates. And perhaps they shouldn't have needed to, but especially in the case of Obama, you'll remember that his actual pastor, Jeremiah Wright, was drummed out of his church after the right-wing media got on him. And I got to say, maybe I'm a little radicalized, like, 8-9 years later, and particularly having attended a Black church for the past year, like, I listened back to some of the stuff that Wright said, and, you know, he was angry, and he's got a right to be angry. You know, having followed him and reported on him over the years, he's maybe not the most temperate person who you would want providing pastoral advice to a candidate, but setting that aside, it wasn't even an option for Obama. So the fact that he had somebody like Joshua in his orbit who could provide that support for him, in addition to coming up with a strategy for faith outreach, he did. And that was just really lucky for Obama. Burns kind of played that same role for Hillary. And I think we should talk about why the two of them are such exceptions, because they both had the ear and the trust of their candidate. And that is really, really important, mostly because it says to other senior staff on the campaign, this matters to me, so you need to listen to these people because of that. It doesn't require coming up with an argument that, you know, convinces people who have been professional Democratic staff for decades that they need to care about religion. They don't get to argue that because the principal has said it matters to me. Burns wasn't there. There wasn't anybody in that senior role. Therefore, there wasn't even anybody in that junior role in Hillary's 2016 campaign. Therefore, they did nothing on faith. And I gotta say, this is all making it seem so much clearer to me now, because I spent much of 2016 asking, why isn't Burns working for Hillary? I mean, he was with her in 2008, and this is the real deal. Now she's got the nomination. She's running for the White House. Like, she needs him. And in retrospect, I see people were kind of stepping around my questions and not really telling me what was going on. But it just, it confounded me why there was nothing happening. And it's now made clear. As you say, like, there needs to be a deeper bench. I have a little trouble with the idea that there isn't a bench, just because there are a whole lot of people in Democratic politics who have who are personally religious, who have deep faith backgrounds, who could do this work. But again, it is a matter of needing to be brought up to a senior level by the principal. And that is rare. Like, if you think back to the party conventions in the summer of 2016, what was really interesting to me is there was virtually no religion in the RNC, which is a little unusual. And it was all over the Democratic convention. There were gospel choirs singing. Reverend Barber was there.
Dude. I was going to say, Reverend Barber, I still remember his sermon. I just remember watching him on the screen going, damn.
Yeah. A couple of the nuns were there from the Nuns on the Bus. Tim Kaine was talking about his time as a Catholic
missionary
in the Central America. Hillary Clinton was talking about her
Methodist faith.
Plenty of people who spoke on her behalf mentioned her Methodist faith. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the woman who was in charge of the Democratic Convention that cycle was Leah Daughtry, who used to be chief of staff at the DNC when Howard Dean was chair. She's herself a minister. She's ordained. And she gets this stuff. And so it always kind of amused me a little bit that Howard Dean, who was himself not at all religious, ran a DNC that actually did a really good job doing some faith outreach, in large part, again, because he had a senior staffer who understood the importance of this stuff. And it seems like such a relatively trivial thing, but I cannot emphasize to you enough how much that and just kind of the role of luck matters in the Democratic Party. And that cannot be how they do faith outreach. It can't just be an ad hoc cycle by cycle thing that just depends on a personal relationship between a candidate and one of their staff members. Like, it's got to be something that the party buys into, not as a way of pandering, not as a way of moving right, but as a way of acknowledging that it matters to a lot of their candidates. And therefore, to leave them unstaffed, you would never have a Barack Obama campaign that didn't have somebody doing outreach on race. You wouldn't have a Hillary Clinton campaign that didn't include somebody doing outreach to women and on women's issues. And for both of them, it mattered to have somebody doing outreach. You couldn't even go to the Hillary Clinton campaign shop online and get a People of Faith for Hillary bumper sticker. It was not available. You could get it every other Democratic category for Hillary bumper sticker. But in 2016, that was not there.
Yep. Which, I mean, it drives me crazy as someone who I am a registered independent, but I do identify majorly with all the policies of the Democratic Party. I mean, and my faith compels me to, right? That, like, it's frankly really easy. Like, there are so many different ways that you can approach Democratic policies from a profoundly, if you just look at it through a Christian lens, through a profoundly biblical worldview. I mean, Reverend Barber made that incredibly clear at the Democratic Convention. It's actually not hard. It's not hard to make the link. It's not hard to argue and support and emphatically, like, propose deeply democratic policies through a faith lens. And this is one of the biggest problems that I have currently with the Democratic Party as opposed to the Republican Party. Like, the Republican Party, for all of their faults and all of their crap and everything and all of their Donald Trump and, like, all of it, racism, misogyny, you name it, they have somehow through, I mean, and it didn't happen overnight. Like, it's been a long trajectory, but the Republican Party has done a really good job at occupying the corner on faith. They have described and articulated so many of the Republican policies through the lens of faith, which makes it easier for folks who may be even a little centrist to go, oh, well, they're speaking this language of my faith, of this worldview that I hold through which I see everything in the world. They're speaking that language. And so it's going to intimately and ultimately pull you in that direction. It's not hard to do it on the other side. It's really not. There's just, frankly, an unwillingness.
Well, and just to give an example here, because I know sometimes it can seem vague when I talk about faith outreach, like what does that mean? What did Burns do? Just one example during the primaries in 2008. He knew, because he knew the Clintons, that in their time in Arkansas, they had been really close to a lot of Pentecostal communities in Arkansas. And in fact, every summer had attended some revivals and were just really comfortable with those communities. And he also knew, given the history of Pentecostals and their willingness to have women as leaders and to be multiracial at a time when that was unusual, really unusual in American religion, he knew that they would be more willing to sit down with Hillary Clinton and consider her as a potential leader than maybe some other evangelical groups. So he, you know, was really astute in knowing that he could set up some meetings for her with Pentecostal leaders and groups, and that those might be positive and they'd go well, and they did. He also knew that when he was looking across the South, you know, in general, he wasn't going to have her meeting with groups of evangelical pastors who hated her, but he knew there's a difference between a Southern Baptist pastor and a pastor whose church is part of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, say. That it's not a matter of completely writing off all evangelicals or sitting down with people who are just going to lecture you, that, you know, it's possible to know your stuff well enough to be able to set up meetings that are going to be productive and effective. And that stuff, like, there are people in the Democratic Party who know how to do that. It's just a matter of convincing some of the powers that be that it is of value. And I think, you know, just to name one potential candidate for 2020, somebody like Kirsten Gillibrand is really good, surprisingly good, given that she still kind of looks like a blonde cheerleader, at going into Black churches and talking and having the language of faith. And I want to say that she attended Redeemer Prez in New York City with Tim Keller's church for a while. Like, she is a Christian through and through who has this stuff in her blood. She knows the language. But I guarantee if she doesn't have somebody staffing her on this, if she runs for president, her campaign will not be doing faith outreach, and they will not know how to weave it into her speeches unless she is doing it herself. And that is too much pressure to put on the principal in campaigns like this. So this is just my warning to you, professional Democrats. This should be a wake-up. The fact that one guy being dismissed over sexual harassment charges, and I think that's how it should have been, meant that the entire Clinton campaign was devoid of anybody focused on faith outreach is just malpractice.
Yeah, it's kind of asinine, frankly. It's just, yeah, I look at it, and I mean, at the end of the day, I understand. I understand that the Democratic Party, I understand that individual campaigns have X amount of dollars, right? I get it. I get that there's a limited amount of cash with a short amount of time, and you got to maximize every dollar that you've got when you run a campaign. I know and understand that.
But they had millions of dollars.
Gazillions upon gazillions of dollars.
They could afford $60,000 for somebody good in this position.
That's right. Yeah. And an assistant or a deputy, whatever you want to call it. And
an intern.
Yes. Yeah, literally anybody.
In fact, I have been like working with folks to convince seminaries that they should let their people do like political or policy internships and let that count is field work. And in some places, we're having a little success. But
hey,
awesome. There are people, that's a win-win then, because they're getting credit for it and you get somebody who absolutely knows what they're talking about.
And is passionate about it, right? And like wants to learn. And at the end of the day, like I understand all of those things, right? Like there is a limited amount of cash. You do have a limited amount of time. But what do you have to lose? The only thing you have to gain is voters. Truly. Like you only have voters to gain. You're not going to lose anyone because you're reaching out to faith outreach, or you're reaching out to people of faith. You're not going to lose
That's
anybody.
That's just the way you think. We could do a whole future episode on this.
We're going to have to, because
welcome to the last 15 years of my life.
I know. And you've written this. You've written, you, Amy, you literally wrote the book on this.
I literally wrote the book on it.
You should, this is a good time to plug your book. You should do it.
Oh, The Party Faithful. Although I need a new subtitle, How and Why Democrats Are Closing the God Gap. They were 2008 when the book came out.
We were doing so
They're
well.
They're not anymore.
We were doing so well. And then we
All right.
blew it. Okay.
Let's wrap up the show. Yeah. Every week, we like to leave you with a recommendation. Maybe a TV show, a movie, some music, a podcast, a book. Nish, what do you have for us this week?
This week, well, we are recording this on Monday morning. The Grammy Awards were last night. And the recommendation that I have for everybody is to go online in your handy little Google search. I want you to type in Kendrick Lamar's 2018 Grammy performance. And then I want you to watch the video, because Kendrick Lamar might be one of the greatest MCs in a generation. Like, the dude is unbelievable. What he does lyrically, what he does performatively, like, the guy is second to none. He is the greatest. And what he did on the Grammy stage, he came out. I can't even describe it. I don't even want to try to describe it, because I will not do it justice. You just need to go watch it. But the emotions that it evoked were so raw and so powerful, and asked really deep questions about, you know, what it means to be a Black man and what it means to be Black in America. And there was rage there. There was sadness there. There were questions there. Bono and the Edge came out in the middle of it and did a little line. Like, it was, yeah, bananas. So
can
good.
We also add, he is all about God and faith.
Yes. There's actually a great article in the Washington Post today. Shout out to our friend Tyler Huckabee, who said that hip hop is having a God moment, and that Kendrick Lamar is kind of one of the big reasons for that. The other one, there's a lot of different
Lecrae,
reasons. Chance the Rapper. Going to a Chance the Rapper show is like going
place.
To church. But Kendrick Lamar's performance last night at the Grammys was so powerful. You could not take your eyes off the guy. He's just such an enigmatic, incredible performer. And you should watch it. It was fantastic. I love award shows. I, as not fashionable as I am, I actually do love fashion. I like looking at what everyone's wearing. I'm one of those people. But also, I love Grammy performances. They're always so unique, and there's usually guest artists, and, you know, people collaborate in different ways, and just fantastic. There was also a performance by Chris Stapleton and Emmylou Harris, if you like either of them. I'm going gray, and my goal is to do the full Emmylou. I want, like, long, beautiful silver hair. But she's... Yes, they did a tribute to Tom Petty. And yeah, so that's worth watching. Anyway, all the performances are great, but make sure you look up the Kendrick Lamar performance. You will not be disappointed, especially if you're a Kendrick fan, a hip-hop fan. You will be so happy you did. You're welcome in advance. Amy, what about you? What's your choice this week?
Well, Nish, as you know, I am still unpacking boxes here a good 5 months after we moved into our house.
It's the nature of moving.
This is going to be like me every week for the next 5 years, probably.
Yeah.
And in addition to all of the Amy Grant piano music books that I texted
saw
you pictures of, I was so excited.
It was like Amy Grant Palooza in your house. It was amazing.
And I don't even think I sent you the picture of my Michael W. Smith friends, which I can play without even looking at the music still. It's just in my fingers.
Oh, man, that takes me back.
Yeah, we'll have a sing-along sometime. What I have also found in one of the books was my maternal grandmother's recipe box, which I just love. I love it for so many reasons, both because a lot of the recipes are written out in her hand. Oh. A lot of them are written out in her mother's hand or her mother-in-law's hand.
Wow.
So these are like family recipes going way back. I love so much that she was of the era where like she worked full time for most of her life, and hard work, like factory line work. So she was of the era where women needed convenience foods.
Yeah.
And boy, was Jell-O there ready to step in and provide convenience foods. So in the entire like salad section of this box.
Oh gosh.
Every single thing that is labeled salad
has Jell-O in
includes
it.
Jell-O. Oh yes. Yeah.
That's so
there
very
is
Mormon
no,
too.
Like chopped lettuce even. Oh no. There is one that has, I want to say, celery and nuts with some cottage cheese on top. And that was kind of turning my stomach.
Ooh.
But I was loving all of the things with names like Dream Whip Salad or Ambrosia or Chiffon or Delight or Jubilee. And
the best
is like Surprise. The Cherry Surprise.
Ambrosia Surprise. I don't even want to know what's in that.
One of the things I love flipping through it is this was a woman who like lived a block from their church and she organized so many potlucks at the Baptist church. And so every so often I will come across a card and there's one here that she hand wrote out that's orange pineapple punch. And it of course involves like Kool-Aid, ginger ale, orange sherbet and pineapple juice.
Oh, the classic.
But at the very bottom, she's written serves 250. And like, how many times do you get a recipe that serves 250? I just love this so much.
That's amazing.
So it reminded me of some of my favorite books that I have on my bookshelf, because every so often I just get so into the idea of like food and religion or food and culture that I want to read more about it. So I have a few to pass on to you.
Ooh, yes.
The readers. There's one called White Bread Protestants. By a guy, Daniel Sack, and I'll put these on our Facebook page.
That is a great
name. That just
name.
Made me so happy. It's all about church potlucks. It's all about, like, in the 50s, Catholic parishes trying to, like, have cool, like, luau-themed gatherings to try to get the young kids interested in, like, hanging out at church. It's got something in there about how grape juice came to be the non-alcoholic like communion serving. And I believe it was a Methodist dentist who figured out the what is it called? The carbonation process to make Welch's grape juice. And then like, I don't know, did some deal with churches where they could get Welch's to serve. And it was also like part of the temperance movement. Like it's just, it's fascinating history. And then there are two books by a food historian named Laura Shapiro. One is Something from the Oven that's all about 1950s America and all about like the marketing of Jell-O and other similar products to try to convince America's moms that not only was this like a quick way to put dinner on the table, but that it was the like the higher form of feeding your family, that if you had to actually like take time to make things by hand, that was not as high class as like being able to open up a can and dump something on a plate. And for a while that worked. And the other one is called Perfection Salad, and it's about women and cooking at the turn of the century. And it's largely about the effort to try to like bring the language of science into cooking, and it's the development of home economics as a field. And Anyway, if you've got the free time.
Yeah.
I read all of these before I had children. And I'm glad that I did. Because I think about them so much. And I think about them fondly when I'm doing things like looking through my grandmother's recipes and trying to get a better picture of what life was like for her as a mom in the 1950s and 1960s.
That's amazing. Okay, now I've got more books to read. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Go rack up my Amazon account. Crap. Okay, well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us and to expand these conversations. And as always, we will post the show notes on our website as well. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.